This is part 4 of 6 of a series about God's government. All 6 parts form a single sermon and must be heard together. No part does or can stand alone. The whole series forms 1 9-hour sermon. I wanted to leave us with a thought from last time, kind of go back in your mind to part 3, and the end of part 3, and we were talking about the fact that the people rejected Samuel, and Samuel felt rejected, and God said, no, they're not rejecting you, Samuel, they are rejecting me. And of course, they wanted a human king. But it's interesting that God considered that he was ruling over Israel even though there was a man there. It was a prophet, a human being, and once they went to a different single man, God no longer felt he was ruling over Israel. Now, I touched on this last time, and the difference, of course, was that you have the human choice on the one hand and God's choice on the other, but in either case, on the surface, it looked like one man. The people got fooled insofar as they thought, well, we better take matters into our own hands because Samuel's sons are going astray, so we'll pick one man, and we want a king. Now, God even selected the king, but he still considered, because they wanted a pattern like the world, he still considered that they had rejected him. Now, that's an extraordinary statement. We didn't talk about that last week. It wasn't God said, all right, go out and get yourself a king. He picked the king and used his servant Samuel to do it and still said, you've rejected me. Now, that's important to understand. That's very, very important to understand, because now we go back to the pattern of Moses. And let's pick up in Numbers chapter 12. We talked about, and I won't review because we have so much to cover, we talked about so many different elements of Old Testament government. And last time we tied in the fact that the church in the Old Testament, and the church in the New Testament, when referenced in both cases in the New Testament, comes from ecclesia. It means the called out people. Whether it's Israel called out of Egypt, or God's people called out of spiritual Egypt, or Babylon. They're both ecclesia. They're called out. And, of course, Revelation 12, we discussed, is a picture of a woman that overarches the Old and New Testament periods. It's not an Old Testament woman and a New Testament woman. It's one woman, one composite woman that takes on the New Testament name, for those, of course, who heard part 3. Now, we then went through, of course, the subject of Samuel. We talked about Moses earlier in the middle of the sermon last time. But now let's go back to Moses, and let's discuss some elements of his leadership where he came under attack on 2 separate occasions. And let's see what we can learn from these occasions, because remember, brethren, I keep saying this, and people in the New Testament tend to forget it. People in the church down through the generations since Christ built the New Testament church tend to forget it. But the Old Testament is there to be examples for the New Testament church, written for our admonition. So some people, of course, would say, well, let's get to the New Testament and see the pattern of church government there. We will. We'll do that. And we'll get into it before today is out, no doubt. But let's understand something. You're studying, according to Paul, in 1 Corinthians 10, you and I are studying New Testament church government when we study the Old. Let's remember, once again, the same God of the Old Testament who established the woman in the wilderness, the church of the Old Testament, established the New Testament church. He says, I change not. I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now, I'm calling it a study of the Old Testament. And then we'll turn and we'll call it a study of the New Testament. There'll be a moment in the sermon today where I will say, now let's turn our attention to the New Testament. But I want you to understand, 1 Corinthians 10 tells us we are studying lessons for the New Testament, obviously when we're reading from the Old. I think, brethren, all of us understand that, but I want to say it especially on this matter of government, because there's a lot in the Old Testament on the subject of government. And it's unfair to the subject to say, well, I want to see the New Testament. I've tried to show you as much background as I could. We are about 4.5 hours into this, and we technically have not looked at the subject of government yet in the New Testament. And we won't for another 30 minutes or an hour. We're going to look at some other things in the Old Testament. And then we will start into the New Testament. All right. Now, that said, turn to Numbers chapter 12. Numbers 12. God has established this man named Moses. Remember, God had to reveal himself to Moses. He was doing something totally new, never done before. He had never worked with anything more, anyone more than a single individual. Now, all of a sudden, 2 to 6 million people God is working with at once. How would he do that? What would he do? He had to reveal himself, we found, to one man. And he had to show the people, as well as Egypt, who had to expel them, that he was working with that one man. He was going to lead those millions of people with that one man. And everybody had to know through a series of 10 miracles, this is the way it is. Now, they couldn't have been expected to understand that God was going to do it that way unless he revealed it, because he had never done this before. He had never worked with a whole group of people. I'm going back to kind of reiterate some of this so I get us back into the understanding of now he's working with a single man who appointed other judges. We understand Jethro told him, you've got to have captains of thousands and hundreds and fifties and so forth. He wasn't the only one administering the government of God to ancient Israel, the church in the wilderness, but he was the one man who was leading it. Now, it was still unclear, how much authority does this man have? That God's revealed to us that he's supposed to take us through the Red Sea and out of here, but then they started running into trouble. They're hungry. They're thirsty. Here comes Pharaoh's army. Just like the church today, difficulties come up. Now, just how much is God with this man, they must have wondered. It certainly didn't have God's Spirit guiding them. They weren't converted. Moses had God's Spirit, but that didn't help him much as far as their willingness to follow him, because they didn't have it. So God had to establish, and we find that he did, certain patterns in people's conduct and what it meant to God when people did certain things to the man he had in charge. All right, now Numbers chapter 12 and verse 1. And Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses. All right, now you have for the first time somebody standing up and saying Moses is doing this, that, or the other because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman. All right, now, that was past tense. Now, all of God's servants make mistakes. We'll talk about that next week or the week after. When God establishes his servants, he also, you will find, establishes that they err. They do some pretty bad things in some cases. In some cases, some outrageous things. Where humanly we would say you would never follow them. But God does not lift his hand from them. Now I'm going to use a graphic example with you to illustrate the point here, because Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of an error. You know, he'd been interracially married in the past. All right, now, what if you heard, for instance, I want to illustrate a point. Now it's going to be graphic. You'll understand exactly why I pick this illustration. What if you heard that I was traveling out of town? I was out in Denver someplace. And some wealthy man who kind of threatened me came to me and said, wow, I'm attracted to your wife. And I'm afraid of him. And you heard that I said, well, that's all right. Take her. She's my sister. What would you do? If you heard that I did that, chances are you wouldn't follow me to the kitchen ever again, let alone as I follow Christ. That's exactly what Abraham did. That's exactly what he did. And you know what? She was his half-sister. So in his mind, he probably thought he was telling the truth. He said, have your way with my wife, because he was frightened. And yet he's called the father of the faithful. Now let's understand, Moses made mistakes. So did others. We'll touch on that later. But I just want you to understand here, he's now under attack for a mistake that he had made, which to some degree was legitimate. It just said, because he'd married an Ethiopian woman, what is God going to allow? How serious is this? Do people have the right to come forward and make these kind of complaints? Does being in charge mean that you can't receive such complaints? We're supposed to learn from this. It's written for our admonition. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Now, that's a fascinating statement. You do these things. Are you the only one? Is there somebody else? Maybe there is more than one. Has he not spoken also by us? Now, here's the problem with what they did. It says, and the Lord heard it. They thought maybe only Moses heard them. They forgot that God heard what they said. Now, the man Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. Now, what's fascinating here, and don't miss this, brethren, because it happened to Mr. Armstrong. It's happened to others of God's greatest servants. What was he accused of? Elevating himself. Are you the only one? You're special? In reality, he was the humblest, the meekest man on earth. Did people see him that way? Of course not. And the Lord spoke suddenly unto Moses and unto Aaron and unto Miriam, come out, you three, unto the tabernacle of the congregation. They three came out. The Lord came down the pillar of the cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forth, and he said, hear now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision and will speak unto him in a dream. My servant is not so, who is faithful in all my house. You've made these charges against him. It's not so. With him will I speak mouth to mouth, even apparently, and not in dark speeches. God had a special relationship. And the similitude of the Lord shall you behold. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Now keep in mind that term, they were not afraid. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. And the cloud departed from the tabernacle, and behold, Miriam came leprous, white as snow. And Aaron looked on Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. Well, you read in verse 14, for 7 days she'll be leprous, and then she'll be healed. Verse 15, this is a lesson nobody forgot. And Miriam was shut out from the camp 7 days, and the people journeyed not till Miriam was brought in again. They all waited day after day, after day after day, after day after day after day, 7 days. They saw her, I don't know, was she standing out on a field somewhere outside the camp under a tree? And they're waiting for her. She's got leprosy. And everybody knows she's got leprosy. There's millions of people waiting for this woman who spoke against Moses. And no doubt they were saying, I don't think I'm going to do that. And they had 7 days to think about it. Moses couldn't smite people with leprosy. Only God could do that. And of course, God cleansed her. Afterward, the people were moved from Hazareth and pitched in the wilderness of Paran, which means, you know, she was restored. All right. Now, they accused. The problem, the sin, if you will, that we are supposed to learn from as we study this for our admonition is they accused God's leader. That's what they did. In just one man, they could accuse any number. People today can accuse any number. But the greatest number of accusations are leveled in our time, 3.5 millennia later, against essentially one man, Herbert W. Armstrong. Whoever is the man God's using, brethren, let me put it plainly, catches it. There's no way around it, because human beings hate government. And the issue, they didn't try to overthrow him. They just said, you have too much authority. Has God only spoken by you? They didn't say, God hasn't spoken by you. But we're okay too. Fascinating story. Just an absolutely fascinating story for those who will be instructed. Now you get a different situation in chapter 16. A lot of people poo-poo this because they don't believe these stories are for us. Chapter 16 and verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath and of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. Now you have a different situation. We all know the story of Korah. It's often referred to as Korah's rebellion. All right, what form would this rebellion take? This is four chapters later. Not a whole lot of time has passed since this lady stood out in the field with a leprous hand. But true to human beings, they forget. Nobody had leprosy for a little while, so they forgot. But this time you have a man who gathered a number of others, and they rose before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown or title and rank. Now let's try to parallel this with 30 years ago in 1974 when a lot of ministers, including some of renown, rose up, princes in the congregation. Very similar situation. And they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said unto them, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them. All the people have God's Spirit, or God is working with them, or they're holy, or however you might put it. Now, they didn't understand they didn't have God's Spirit. They were just flat wrong. God was not working with them. Moses had an element in his mind they did not have, but these men, being carnal themselves, didn't understand it. They said they're all holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Now, if you're the people, this sounds pretty good. Here's a group who are elevating you. Wow, this one guy has taken too much. You take too much, seeing everybody is holy. And when Moses heard it, this is the man who's the meekest man on the face of the earth, he fell upon his face. Now, that's not exactly a picture of arrogance, elevating himself. He flopped down literally in front of 250 princes right on his face. Now, this had to be a strange conversation. What a picture, 250 people challenging him, and he's laying with his nose on the ground. There's no way that at that point they must have been thinking, woo, hitting him with arrogance might not have been the best thing to do. Because look, he's lying there with his nose in the dirt, and we're standing here, 250 of us. And he spoke to Korah, and even from the company, saying, now I don't know, did he speak with his mouth 2 inches or an inch from the ground while his nose is resting on his nose? I don't know. Did he look up? And he fell on his face. Even tomorrow, the Lord will show who are his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near unto him. Even him whom he has chosen will he cause to come near unto him. That's the key. Whom he has chosen. This do, take you censers, Korah, and all his company, and put fire therein, put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow, and it will be that the man whom the Lord does choose, he shall be holy. You take too much upon you, you sons of Levi. He came back with the exact same statement. Now the question is, which is it? Are all the people more important in terms of the way God worked than one man, or is the one man more important in the way God was working? Well, Moses said to Korah, here I pray you, you sons of Levi, seems it but a small thing unto you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself. You do not appreciate the tremendous responsibility you have. You senior ministers, as it were, we could say. You princes. And you get to work closer to God than others. the service of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to minister unto them. You have this awesome responsibility. He's brought you near him and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you, and seek you the priesthood also. They're trying to assert themselves, for which cause both you and all the company are gathered together against the Lord. He didn't say you're against me. He said you're against the Lord. And what is Aaron that you murmur against him? So Moses' chief assistant was catching it too. And Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, which said, we will not come up. Absolute defiance. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land that flows with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? Things go wrong. That's when the leader is tested. That's when people murmur. That's when he gets challenged. Well, things always go wrong where you have flesh. The church has never had smooth sailing. There's persecution and difficulties and trials and heresy and division and all kinds of problems, Old Testament and New. So there's always going to be that inevitable time when it doesn't seem like the church is flowing with enough milk and honey. Always going to seem that way. To kill us in the wilderness, except you make yourself altogether a prince over us. Now, the ultimate question here, let's be honest. They said, you take too much upon you. They didn't say God gave you too much. They were worse than Aaron and Miriam. They said, you know, you only. Are you only? Here they said, you take. You take this yourself. We're all as good as you. We ought to be having a group think here. They didn't understand. They did not see God. In all honesty, they just didn't see God. Now, they were about to. Moreover, you have not brought us into the land that flows with milk and honey or given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. Do you have the power to blind them? Do something. Come on, bring a plague, Mr. Tough Guy. That's what they're saying. Boy, just a cynical attitude, defiant attitude. And Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, respect not you their offering. I have not taken one ass from them, neither have I hurt one of them. But look at what they said about him, and he was innocent. And Moses said to Korah, be you and all your company before the Lord, you and they and Aaron tomorrow. Well, take every man his censer and so forth. And Korah, verse 19, gathered all the congregation against them unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. The Lord, glory of the Lord appeared unto all the congregation. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation. Get away. They're about to take it, that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell upon their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and will you be angry with the whole congregation? The people were just trundling along. The 250 people looked more right than one or two, Moses and Aaron together. And they didn't have God's spirit. They were confused. And Moses, even though they were standing against him, all these people, millions standing against him, said, please don't wipe them out. It's the rebels who were doing this. Moses rose up and went to Dathan and Abiram, verse 25, and spoke to the congregation, saying, depart, I pray you, from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. Verse 26. Verse 27, so they got up from the tabernacle of Korah, Dathan, Abiram, on every side. And these men came out, stood in the door of their tents, and their wives and their sons and their little children. And Moses said, hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own hand. This is the ultimate question about every man that God uses. Has he done things by his own hand? Did Herbert Armstrong? Did Peter? Did the judges? Did Abraham? Did Moses? Did Samuel? Verse 29, if these men die the common death of all men, in other words, they live to a ripe old age, if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord make a new thing, and the earth open her mouth and swallow them up with all that appertain unto them, They're standing there with their children, everything. And they go down quick into the pit. Wives, children, houses, possession, everything. Then you shall understand that these men have provoked the Lord. They didn't provoke me, Moses. And it came to pass, as he'd made an end of the speaking all these words, that the ground clave asunder that was under them, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, their houses, and all the men that appertained unto Korah, and all their goods, everything gone. They and all that appertained to them went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed upon them, and they perished from among the congregation. And all Israel that were round about them fled at the cry of them, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. And there came out a fire from the Lord, consumed the 250 men that offered incense, burnt them up. What a horrific sight. The Lord spoke to Moses, speak to Eleazar, and so forth. Verse 41. But on the morrow, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, you have killed the people of the Lord. Now look, you could sort of say today, if a minister had to disfellowship someone, you disfellowship him. People might not see that God did it. But you tell me, brethren, how human beings could one day later forget that the earthquake came and no human being can cause an earthquake. I don't care if Moses was 100 feet tall. He can't split the earth and throw all kinds of families and houses in there. God did that. And yet people, in the face of what God does, and this is one of the lessons here, and there are many, people in the face of what God does can forget almost immediately mighty miracles. Now, brethren, here's my question. Do you think 3,500 years later, people will not forget this message when the people right there who fled the day earlier when they saw the earthquake then said, you killed them? When Mr. Armstrong disfellowshipped people down through the years, he got blamed. You put them out. And these men are now, many of them still alive, telling and spinning their own stories. They're on the internet. They're in various different newspapers that are produced out there. They tell their story. And the people are letting it all blur in their mind. They're just confused. Wow, I didn't know it was that way. Mr. Armstrong told us you were a rebel back there in the 70s. Or the late early 70s and late 70s. But now you're telling us there's another story. I don't know. See, God in the New Testament doesn't cause earthquakes because he's not controlling the whole country. If it was the whole country, we might have earthquakes again. But now in the New Testament church, of course, you disfellowship. You still remove them. But they're still alive. Now, nobody had the option of going to fellowship with Korah and say, Korah, now that this is all over, give us your opinion. You have any new thoughts on this? He was 150 feet down, crushed, gone, everything with him. But today, people can tell their story against government. They can speak and talk. And it all comes down to they were not afraid. They were not afraid to speak evil. Now, we could ask this question before we go to the New Testament. How did Korah get these intelligent senior leaders to go along with him? How did he do it? It must have been something unbelievable. So soon after mighty miracles had occurred, he got 250 leaders who had seen the pillar in the cloud day after day. The presence of God was unmistakable. You don't look out the window here, brethren, and all of you around the world hearing this sermon. You can't look outside and see the pillar of the cloud and the fire by day and night. You can't do that. These people did, and they still went against Moses and still blamed him after it was over. Now we know there are many carnal minds in the church in the New Testament. They're called tares. They look like wheat. They're not. They're lethal inside, and we must not forget that. They hate government as much as Korah himself. They will accuse and attack as much as Aaron and Miriam or Korah or any other. Why did Korah not fear to speak against Moses? The answer is people do not want to be governed. Now, we might ask, before we move toward the New Testament, When we, you, me, any of us, complain or murmur against authority, you say, well, Mr. Pack, you can't complain against authority. You're in charge. Well, all right, then we'll look back in the past, because for most of my ministry, I was not in charge of the church under Christ. I wasn't. I understand that. So, I'll look back in the past, and I know what I'd answer, by the way. Well, how would you answer? When you complain or murmur, how different are you than ancient Israel? Now, I'm just going to plant that seed. I don't want to talk a lot about it at this point, but I'm just going to plant the seed. You think about it. Now, in the New Testament, there's a fascinating example of how when you understand the government, your faith grows. Or, put another way, turn it over, if you have faith, you will understand government. Now, the problem with Korah was they didn't see God. They thought that Moses was just some local politician who rose up, seized power, like some revolutionary dictator, Castro, Che, just got hold of power and took too much to himself. He did it. They didn't see God in it. Now let's turn over to Matthew 8, and let's start in the New Testament by looking at a fascinating example that you would never think has anything to do with government. But now in the New Testament, we understand the turf has changed in one way. We are now dealing with people in whom is God's Spirit, where God is present in them. Now, all the people, technically, brethren, are holy. Do we now see, though, that God has become the ultimate Democrat and he works through everyone? What's the New Testament picture? The first time you really come to the subject of government in the New Testament is in a strange place. I wonder if you would guess what it was if I said, where in the New Testament do you first begin to be instructed by government? Where would it be? Well, I'll tell you, it's right after the Sermon on the Mount. In chapter 8, verse 1, the sermon ends in chapter 7 with the words, and he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. He didn't go around quoting sources. He spoke as though he had authority. When he was come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. Well, there's this leper. He healed this leper. You come to verse 5. And when Jesus was come into Capernaum, there came unto him a centurion. Now, there was a movie out 20 years ago called The Young Centurions, or The Modern Centurions, or something. A centurion comes from century. It means 100. This is a soldier, perhaps a lieutenant or a captain, we might say today, who's over 100 soldiers. This is a centurion. Beseeching him and saying, Lord, my servant lies at home sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. Here's the problem, by the way, that Korah had. This man actually defines it. And Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, now listen to this, stops him, says, stop. No, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof. First of all, he had tremendous humility, yet he was in charge. But speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. Now, how did he know that? What gave him that understanding, that he didn't have to be there physically? It wasn't Christ's physical presence that was going to create the healing. Here's what he said. For I am a man under authority. What? I thought we're talking about healing here. Now all of a sudden the subjects have switched to authority? I'm a man under authority, having soldiers under me. Now he's not the five-star general, and he's not a buck private. He's kind of a lieutenant, captain, major, somewhere in the middle there. Or sergeant, maybe you'd say. And I say to this man, go, and he goes. I understand authority. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. Now, let me stop and say, if you've been in the military, you've heard me say this many times, my family's a lot of military, you know, when they tell you to do something, there's authority. And they teach you, they drill you, they condition you to understand there's authority. Because if people don't follow authority in the military, as I think I've explained before, people could get injured. Fellow soldiers could get captured. Or they could die because people defied authority. Now, men understand that. The centurion understood that. What's that got to do with the point here? Just this. He knew it was enough because Christ carried authority that he just spoke the word. He didn't have to be there. It wasn't his physical presence that was going to create the healing. What gave the man faith is he understood how authority works. And where there is, in this case, God's authority, and this man wasn't under the authority of God, he was under the authority of some Roman soldier over other Roman soldiers, but where there is God's authority, it's going to work the same way. If Christ said, this is the way it is, Christ was under the authority of the Father, he just explained that, it was going to be, it's that simple, it's going to be a healing. Verse 10, when Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to them that followed, verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. I thought we just had a discussion about authority. No, it was a discussion about faith that flowed off of authority. I have not found so great a faith, no, not in Israel. And here it's coming from this Roman soldier. Now, brethren, here is my point. And we need to understand this. Never forget the lesson. Because you've now just been introduced for the first time, believe it or not, in this context of healing, to the subject of government in the New Testament. Here is the point. If you have absolute faith in God, you will understand government. If you understand government, it will increase your faith. If you understand where there's authority, God backs it up. The centurion knew Christ was backed up. He wasn't there of his own authority. He wasn't some witch doctor in the village who needed to come in and physically present, pour out incantations over this sick person, his servant, in order to heal him. It was a matter of authority. Christ could have been 12 time zones away. And because he was under authority, and this man understood authority, knew that God would perform the healing through him wherever he was. You want to grow in faith, grow in your understanding of how God's government works. You want to grow in how God's government works, grow in faith. Now listen, brethren, I've said for years, and I hope we can see the connection here, God's people lost faith in Christ's ability to govern his church. The greatest single thing that the devil did in the 20th century after the death of this great servant, this sort of New Testament Moses, was to destroy people's almost universal willingness to believe that Christ was capable of governing his church. Now he isn't, and all the people are holy, and we're not going to ever follow one man again. And there's no end of princes out there willing to tell people exactly what their human nature already wants to hear. An extraordinary story, if you consider it. Christ said in Luke 18:8, we won't turn over there, but you can write it down, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? I'll tell you where he'll find the most of it, on people who understand authority. You think about what I said, brethren. In the age when the people rule and they do not understand that God backs up those whom he chooses, who have not taken anything to themselves, I'll say again to you, and you'll have to be the judge. You be the judge. Nobody could want this job. You'll find in other places, Moses wanted to die. It was a terrible job. People moaned no matter what he did. He caught it over and over. They didn't care if people got leprosy or earthquakes came or there were plagues or anything else. They just keep on murmuring and complaining. And yet he would catch himself and he would stop God. He didn't want God to wipe them all out. But at times he must have thought, did I do the right thing? Maybe I should let God wipe them all out. Because God in one place said, you know, I'll make of you a great nation. Now, how would that appeal to you? So he loved the people, and he understood that people could be deluded by princes who rise up and lie to them about their role in the way the church in the modern age or the church in the Old Testament should be led. Brethren, think about these things. I'm going to take you later on in the last sermon into various places where the word warning is used. God issues warnings to us. Let's think about these things. Now we come to the New Testament. And I'd like to read some things to you before we get into the New Testament. And I may periodically, in these last three sermons, bring, I guess, what could be called an inset to the sermon. I'm just going to throw in some things here and there to think about. Now, I said in the first part, now 4 weeks ago, that we live in and are exposed to, and to some degree are conditioned by the age around us. We really are, brethren, more than we realize. Now, this is the age we live in. I want to read to you several different quotes for a moment. Here's a very brief one. This is about a week and a half ago, out of Germany. Short article. This is the way people view government in the world today. From Mannheim, Germany. A man slapped Chancellor Gerhard Schröder in the face during a campaign rally Tuesday, causing no apparent injury. Do you think any man would have walked up to Adolf Hitler 50 years ago and slapped him? No, I don't think so. No. The man lunged at Schröder while he was giving autographs to a crowd of people in a Mannheim Civic Center during a campaign stop for his party ahead of the European Parliament elections next month. Security agents subdued the man. Police took him into custody, said this spokesperson. That's all it says. Can you imagine? Think of the attitude that would allow somebody to believe he could do that. Here's a different one. Same day, Blair attacked in Commons. He's giving a speech. Some of you may have seen the pictures of this. A protester hit Tony Blair with a bag of purple paint powder as he spoke in the Commons today, sparking a full-scale security scare. It was just powder. Hit him right in the back. I saw it. He threw it from the balcony. A special barrier recently erected to shield MPs against a possible anthrax attack failed to protect the prime minister. This man threw two missiles, they call it, from the balcony, one of which hit Blair's shoulder. And it's this purple dust went all over and got all over everything. And they had to stop because everybody was choking from this dust. They took the guy out. And the prime minister took it pretty well. I could have read the rest of the article here. Schröder took it pretty well. But it's a different attitude today. Now let's move away from the subject of such things happening in the world. And I'd like to read to you a letter that a particular party, I don't know the party, I'm going to use the name John, that's not his name, it's a different name, he signs it by his last name. But for all who are tempted, now speaking of the church, not the world, to want a say in things, here is where this generation wants to take that say. Here is where it goes when the people take charge. Here is a young man in the church who went onto a website and said the following. Listen to this. We'll call him John. Your editorial came at an interesting time, for I was thinking just this morning about how there is a change going on, not only in the churches of God, but in the world of religion in general. How many young people do you see heading up these organizations? Mostly when I think of religious speakers, I think of people such as James Dobson, Billy Graham, or in the Churches of God, Ted Armstrong, etc. And then he mentions even his son isn't exactly a youngster. They're all growing older and older, and soon they'll all die, and they'll have to be replaced by necessity with those that are younger. And soon the generation that is now under 35 will be under 55 and then under 75. This guy thinks got many decades to go. And hopefully once that happens and all the current leadership, and I use that term loosely, I'm still quoting him, is pushing up daisies, there will be a change. We've been living under the thumb of the hyper, ultra, super duper conservative World War II generation for way, way too long. It's time for a change. As an aside, still quoting, sometimes I wonder if the reason the Churches of God discouraged voting was because that's an individual right and that one must exercise according to his or her conscience. They couldn't have that now, could they? And he has that in italics, that. Well, I'm 28 years old and I just registered to vote for the first time in my life. Not only that, but I'm voting for Kerry. They can put that in their pipe and smoke it. Now, that's a young man who attends one of the big splinters, a truly humble servant of God, right? Who sees the big picture. What this young man does not understand is the cycle of democracies. Back in the 1700s, a man named Alexander Tyler said this, and I believe I have it, and it's in my book, Tomorrow's Wonderful World. Quote, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves money from the public treasury." Now, see if this doesn't describe the democracies of the West, particularly Britain and America. "From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most money from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over a loose fiscal policy followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's great civilizations has been 200 years. These nations have progressed through the following sequence." Now, he's saying this at the birth of the American Republic. They progressed through the following sequence: from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness. Are we describing American Britain? From selfishness to complacency, from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependency, from dependency back to bondage under dictatorship. If you want to know where America is going, there's no mystery. It's going back under dictatorship, only it will not happen here. It'll be a foreign dictator. We understand prophecy. When God's people want democracy, they want to follow that pattern, it goes one direction and one direction only. And a lot of God's people, the vast majority of God's people, are going to look that final dictatorship directly in the eye and have to make a decision that only apparently about half of them will make correctly. So says God, not David Pack or Herbert Armstrong. Yes, we are certainly trying to say those things. I'm not trying to lump myself with Mr. Armstrong, but those are the words of the Bible. Listen to what Mr. Armstrong said, and I quote now from his book about the beast, which I put in mine. An incredible quote. This is in the middle section where he's talking about the image of the beast. What is the image of the beast? Of course, the world doesn't know. It took this great servant inspired by God. God's hand was on him, and that's why he understood and could teach us these extraordinary things. But listen to what he said was the image of the beast. "So notice, this two-horned beast not only caused people to receive the mark of the beast, but also perpetrated the forming of an image that caused the martyrdom of saints. As many as would not worship this image were caused to be killed. This false church did not kill them, she caused them to be killed. History shows that the civil government martyred millions who were declared anathema from Christ or heretics. Now compare with the woman who rode the beast in Revelation 17. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus." Certainly these are one and the same. "Now this ecclesiastical organization, which is a twofold government, deceived the people by saying they should make an image of the beast. Note it, Revelation 13:14, that is how it deceived people. What is an image? Dictionaries define it as a likeness or a copy, a representation, model, semblance, or counterpart. So here is a church saying, let's make a model or a counterpart of the civil Roman government, for that is what the beast is. Jesus Christ proclaimed the kingdom, or the government of God, divine government by will of God and by God's law, not paganized human government by will of man and man-made laws. There's a lot at stake on this issue of government, brethren." Now, that's me. Now I'm back to the quote for those who don't know that I'm looking up and down, who are hearing this later. "His church includes all spirit-begotten saints who have and are led by the Holy Spirit. Christ is its only head." Now, he understood that, but did Mr. Armstrong say, "I have no role" when he said that? When God said to Samuel, "They don't want me ruling over them," did he say, "Samuel, you're not in place"? No, he understood Samuel was in place. Where God has selected a man, Christ is the head. Now I'm going back to the quote. "And his kingdom is not of this world. Where then did human church government derive its present form? The first pope, in the real sense of the word, was Leo I, says the Encyclopedia of Biblical, Theological, and Ecclesiastical Literature, volume 7 and page 629. To him, the form of government of the Roman Empire was the most marvelous thing on earth. He applied its principles to the church, organized the church into a government, forming the papacy. This church government or organization is the image of the beast. Humanly devised government, said Herbert Armstrong and no one else I have ever read. Humanly devised church government is the image of the beast. Says Myers, Ancient History, during the reign of Leo I, the church set up within the Roman Empire an ecclesiastical state or government which, in its constitution, its administrative system, was shaping itself upon the imperial model. This church government, then, according to this historical authority, is in fact a model, a counterpart, an image of the beast, which is the Roman Empire government. The Britannica calls it an ecclesiastical world empire. Still quoting Mr. Armstrong, this image, man-designed and man-ruled church government. Anywhere you have that, he's not just saying Rome, compelled people to worship the church. And since the church was organized into a worldly government, this was the worship of the image, false worship and idolatry. Now, a lot of people, by the way, let me cut in on this, some have come along and said, Mr. Armstrong patterned the worldwide Church of God government after Rome. That's what they said. They're saying it out there. There are thousands of people that think Mr. Armstrong got it wrong by copying the Catholics. You're going to find that the Catholics copied and counterfeited what Christ said. God's people, Mr. Armstrong, did not counterfeit the Catholics or copy them. But this church became a mother, and daughter churches came out of her in protest, calling themselves Protestant, and all have worldly political church government. Upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, still quoting Mr. Armstrong. Her daughters are called harlots. Together, they are called Babylon. They are pagan, teaching pagan doctrines and customs, cloaked in the name of Christianity, and all nations are deceived. Yes, human, organized churchianity, not Bible-designed spiritual organism government, the pattern of the Bible, is the image of the beast. It is the pagan political counterfeit of God's government. And Mr. Armstrong ends this quote in this section of his book, come out of her, God says, Revelation 18:4, God help us to heed. End of quote. Now, brethren, when I say there's more, it meets the eye. And when Mr. Armstrong said government is everything, you be the judge. Like Paul said to Corinth, I speak as to wise men, judge you what I say. You better be careful when you say all the people are holy. Any of us, and I'm speaking to hundreds and I hope thousands who will hear these sermons when they're posted, way beyond the shores of RCG. This is a big issue. Faith is tied to it. If government truly is everything, people had better not mess it up. And when they say Mr. Armstrong was wrong in the way he patterned government, and yet flowing from it was the greatest single ministry the world has ever seen, they had better understand what they have decided. For me to come along and choose some different form of government immediately disqualifies me as any kind of Philadelphian remnant leader. Impossible. Because the moment I threw out the doctrine that that man called everything, I haven't held fast. And you know what? I couldn't even hold the church together, not that I'm doing it. I couldn't use the vehicles and the scriptures to hold the church together, nor could the other faithful elders. And we have a lot of faithful elders and deacons where the government of God is employed and restored. It couldn't be done. We would instantly cease to be Philadelphian. And yet, brethren, let me tell you something. To teach government in the Laodicean age takes faith, because people call you harsh, abusive, unjust, wrong. All the people are holy. And after all, God is not smiting people with leprosy today. The earth's not opening up anymore. Far, far more horrible things will come than that soon, but it's not here yet. It's still a beautiful sunny day out there, figuratively speaking. Now let's look, before we look at the pattern in the New Testament, let's turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter 3. I mentioned some weeks ago, I think during Unleavened Bread, that I would be coming back to this. We're going to look at it in a different context. Now, obviously, it's in Satan's interest to have some dictators among God's people, ministers and elders who are harsh and mean, so that those who administrate proper government would be afraid to take a stand and speak boldly and in temperance administer hierarchical government. So there have been abuses and injustices, excesses and harshness. All of God's greatest servants, far greater than this man standing here today, have made serious mistakes. That's just the fact. But then the question is, does that mean God is not with them? So I promised at the outset of Restored, now over 5 years ago, that I would make mistakes. And as I like to tell people, I'm sorry to have to tell people, but I like to tell people, I've kept my word. I've kept my word. I've made mistakes, and I'll make more. But remember, if government was always perfect, and if all of God's servants down through the years were always perfect, brethren, I want you to think about something. The whole world would take on the government of God. Everybody would see there is this perfect place out there where there's never injustice. Every decision is like Solomon saying, divide the baby. It's so wise, it's so perfect, it's so wonderful. There's abundance and joy and supreme happiness. There's prosperity, there's never division. There's this place where every judgment is an oracle. It's perfect. Well, where would there be faith? Well, you wouldn't need any faith. It'd take no faith to believe that you have to stay under a government that it's just obvious nothing ever goes wrong. It's always milk and honey flowing every minute, all the time. The whole world would eventually gravitate to it. Now you say, well, no, they wouldn't. They're going to have to be forced. I understand that. I understand that. But I'm saying where God's Spirit was present, people would all want to stay there. They wouldn't want to go anywhere else. God will pour His Spirit out on the whole world someday, and it will be a perfect government. And I understand some will rebel, and there'll have to be a plague, and there'll have to be no rain on Egypt, and so forth. I understand those verses. Please don't misunderstand that I don't remember them. But I'm just saying within the church, if there was always perfect government, every pastor was perfect, every elder was perfect, every deacon, and they never sinned either. Remember, not just their judgments were perfect, they were perfect people. What could people do? They say, this is just too wonderful. Why would I ever want to go anywhere else? Now we look at 2 Peter chapter 3. This second epistle, beloved, we're going to look at the back end of the story before we go backwards or the other way in the book. This second epistle, beloved, I now write unto you, in both which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. Now, this is always the way it is with God's servants. They have to remind people. Brethren, this series of sermons is reminding you. Mr. Armstrong isn't here to do it. It's my job now to remind you of the subject of government, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets. Yes, people in the first century forgot things that were in the Bible. And of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lust, like John, the guy I quoted. Scoffers. And saying, where is the promise of His coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Time's going on, my Lord delays His coming. For this they willingly are ignorant, and so forth. So we're talking about the last days. Now let's go to chapter 2, the beginning of chapter 2. Go back a page, and we're going to pick up, and we're going to look at something. This is important to understand. Now let's establish something. God has been doing the same work down through history. The work of God, announcing the government of God. All of His prophets spoke that message. Acts 3, 19 to 21, you know the verse. He's a God who doesn't change. His truth is the truth. He's always said His government, Isaiah 9, 6, will be on the shoulder of Christ. He's bringing that government. And of the increase of that government, there'll be no end when the gospel of the kingdom or government of God arrives on earth. And in the church, you cannot forsake assembling yourself together. Now, those are fundamental commands. So somewhere there's a church of people assembling, doing the work, understanding God's government is coming, and believing the truth. Now, I'm telling you these things because there's simplicity in Christ. Along come people and they change all that. We're about to read about how that gets changed. They come along and change the work, the truth, God's government, and you've got to assemble together. God has a church, Christ built his church, and somewhere people are together under his government, doing his work, holding to his truth. If it's not the restored church of God, you have this understanding. It's somewhere. And I tell people, if you're going to leave, know where you're going to go. Have another option. People leave us. I'm trying as much as I possibly can to put them in remembrance of fundamental things in the Bible so that it's hard for them to leave. I understand that some people will run through stop signs like teenage drivers today. They'll just run stop sign after stop sign until they're clear out of town and gone. I know there are people who will run through all God's stop signs. They won't hear the still small voice of His Spirit. They'll forget these sermons. They'll run through every stop sign till they're clear out of the church. They're just gone. I take a walk in the area where there's some teenagers live. Stop signs are for other people. They don't even slow down. They'll look to see if there's a policeman there, and then they just roll right on through. I'm hoping that you will understand that as I teach all of the doctrines of God, as Mr. Armstrong taught us from God, that these are so many stop signs, you have to blow through all of them. And the ultimate stop sign that towers over the whole town, the whole church, is government. You have to blow through all of them, through all the caution lights, all the yield signs to get out of town and out of the church. And I hope that with these sermons, I'm presenting a pattern to God's people where they will fear to do that. All right, now we're in chapter 2. But there were false prophets also among the people, Old Testament and New. Look at this. Even as there shall be false teachers among you. All right, now we're looking here at a statement that parallels Old and New Testament. Peter wasn't confused. He knew that you're supposed to learn from the Old Testament about people who could come among you who privately shall bring in damnable heresies. Well, that's exactly what we saw back in the 90s. One doctrine after another coming into the church. Where did that come in? Where did that come in? And privately means craftily, secretly, cunningly, privately. One after another. And the brethren didn't understand until the wool had been pulled completely over their eyes. Even denying the Lord that bought them. Yes, we saw the doctrine of the Antichrist taught behind us in at least four separate ways, and I've explained that in other sermons. When you teach, for instance, the Trinity doctrine, that's the doctrine of the Antichrist. One third of one being cannot die. One third of one single being cannot die. But if God is more than one being, we know He's two, one can die and the other one can live. But you can't have a third of a being die. That's one way. You deny the Lord that bought them and bring upon themselves swift destruction. Old Testament and New. This is Peter talking. We will see the leader of God's church is warning the people. And a chapter later said, I'm trying to bring you into remembrance. And many, when this happens, what will happen? What would we expect to happen when people come along and do this? Many shall follow their pernicious ways, their lascivious ways. What's going on privately in their life? By reason of whom? Now, what would you expect them to do? What form will it take? What form will these people take that somehow gets many to follow them? By reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. Not necessarily all of the truth. Might be some of the truth. Might be the truth about church government. Might be about, yeah, women can wear makeup. Herbert Armstrong went back and forth on that. And you know, that's an administrative issue. That was a policy thing. That's not truth. I'm sorry, but it was truth. As the only man in this age who's written a booklet, other than Mr. Armstrong on it, and who's gotten the facts from what he taught, I'm sorry, that is a doctrine. Well, I think we should keep birthdays, or I don't think it's a big deal if we marry outside the church, or government isn't that important. Who cares? I don't know if Mr. Armstrong was the Elijah. People throw out truth, throw in their own ideas. It may be all of the truth, like the apostates. They threw it all out, or it may be the splinters that throw some of it out. And through covetousness, shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you? They have to offer you something to get their tithes. Where God is working, there has to be faith. I know some could leave us as a result of this sermon. And I'm the guy who has to sit down and figure out how to pay the bills. And I know that prophecy says we're not rich and increased with goods. I know there are doctrines I could preach today that would bring hundreds of thousands of dollars into this work. I could do it that fast. I just tell women, for instance, and you automatically got a message for one half of them, put your makeup back on. We'd lose a few, gain a lot. Assuming all the women left, it'd still be a few, is what I'm saying. If I was seductive enough, I could get some of our women to put their makeup back on and not leave and keep their tithes too, and then get a whole bunch more. Now, I'm giving you an example, brethren, how you make merchandise. Oh, we won't bring harsh, tough government like that mean old Herbert W. Armstrong did. You'll have a voice here. And then we'll have your tithes. But they don't say that part. They just think it. Whose judgment now of a long time lingers, and their damnation slumbers not. For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment, and spared not the old world, you think God winks at this stuff? He's punished angels, and he punished the entire world except for eight people. You think God won't punish people who have this attitude? No, let's keep reading. But save Noah and seven other people, as preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. And then what about Sodom and Gomorrah? And turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes and condemned them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those that after should live ungodly. Well, wow, he's setting up the stage here. What are we talking about? What's the subject? And he delivered just Lot. Well, you can take that two ways. He delivered justified, a man who was just, or he delivered just Lot, nobody else. It means the former, but you could take it as the latter. I realize his daughters came with him, so it's just Lot and his daughters, if you put it that way. Having a little fun. Vexed with the filthy conduct of the wicked. It was hard to live in that world. And brethren, Christ said it would be like Sodom and Gomorrah today. And many of us, I hope, are vexed by the world around us. It's just hard to turn on television. I have to hit the mute button all the time, constantly, because of what's going on out there. For that righteous man dwelling among them and seeing and hearing vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. I hope all of us, brethren, feel the same way. And if we don't, I would ask why. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. Now, let me tell you something. I don't know how God is going to protect this church. I know that He's going to protect it. I don't lose one wink of sleep wondering how God will get us to the place of safety, because I know this much. It will take a series of, certainly more than one, a series of miracles that we could never anticipate any more than ancient Israel could sit there and say, how in the world are we going to get out of this powerful army? There's deserts everywhere. What? It took miracles. Who knows? Oceans might part. I don't know how it will work. I have no idea. But I know that when people see those miracles, because that's the lesson from Korah, it won't move the world. It'll move us. How fast did Pharaoh forget the miracles that had occurred back there before the army disappeared? How fast? Real fast. God will get us out. Any of it, it's a matter of faith. Don't worry about it. Don't think about it. God will show us how He'll do it. Now, that's an aside. But chiefly them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise government, or the margin says dominion. Christ's government is called dominion. It's either one. They don't want, now the word dominance comes from that. They don't want government. Presumptuous are they. They're the kind of people who say, you take too much. They presume to stand up as a prince of the people. We're all holy. You take too much. Self-willed. Remember that word I told you to remember back there in the Old Testament? I was, with Aaron and Miriam, and of course later with Korah, the word afraid. Why were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Here it is again, New Testament, nothing new under the sun. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignities. All of a sudden, that brings to mind those stories. This is New Testament. Let's keep reading. They are not afraid. Oh, he's surely not talking about Korah. This is the New Testament. But keep in mind, I ask you, why was it Korah was willing to speak against Moses? Why? He didn't see God. He was not afraid. He hated government. We all want a voice. Whereas angels, which are greater in power and might, bring not railing accusation against them before the Lord. But these as natural brute beasts, God calls those who hate government, who despise it. You know what despise means? They despise it and speak evil of dignities. They think nothing of speaking against the ministry. Yes, there are many, many weak ministers out there. There are splinters that are led by blaspheming false prophets. I understand that. They're not of God. There's others led by weak brothers. And people will speak against dignities of any kind. Mr. Armstrong was careful not to speak against the Pope. Call him names. He didn't do it. He said, we don't need to do that. He has an office. So people who go out there and cream and smear by name various parties make a grievous error. Grievous error. But these as natural brute beasts, made to be taken and destroyed, speak evil of the things that they understand not. They don't understand God's government. They shall utterly perish in their own corruption, and receive the reward of unrighteousness as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Spots they are, and blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings while they feast with you. Yes, brethren, these kinds of people get into the church. Now, the context here is in the wake of an apostasy, beginning of chapter 2, where the truth is evil spoken of, and many follow their lascivious or pernicious ways, and is in the context of the last days. There'll be scoffers. This is us. This is a warning for us. Having eyes full of adultery, and it cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls. Yes, there's some in the church who get fooled by them. They make good arguments. If you're listening to Korah, 250 people bought in. They were beguiled. As surely as the devil beguiled Eve in the garden. And heart they've exercised with covetous practices, cursed children, which have forsaken the right way and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Bosor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness, but was rebuked for his iniquity. The dumb ass speaking with man's voice forbade the madness of that prophet. These are wells without water, carried with a tempest, to whom is the mist of darkness is reserved forever. These people are going to die. The angels are going to go to outer darkness, of whom they are a type, but these people will die. They will go down into silence, and their thoughts will perish, and there'll be ashes under the feet of the righteous. For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness. Now, the subject here is government. They're against government and against the truth. It's interesting. As he is talking about the subject of truth, brethren, what's the one doctrine he chooses to talk about? Does he talk about the born-again doctrine? Does he talk about the Sabbath, the holy days? Those are all truths, no doubt. Tithing, clean and unclean meats. The truth of salvation, the nature of the gospel, well, indirectly he does. He selects government. It all starts with government coming from people who are with you. Verse 19, they promise them liberty. They themselves, or while they promise them liberty, they themselves are the servants of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same is he brought in bondage. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world, so many escaped and understood, through the knowledge of their Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome. The latter end is worse with them than the beginning. It's better that they'd not known the way of righteousness than after they'd known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them. For it has happened unto them, according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed were wallowing in the mire. How so many of God's people who supposedly survived the apostasy could go back to the world's forms of government. I'm not saying the splinters have the image of the beast, but you take what Mr. Armstrong said. If they go back and they pick humanly devised government, You say, you determine, I speak as to wise men, judge you what I say. How different is their government if it's humanly devised than the description in Mr. Armstrong's Beast booklet about the image of the beast? And now you're there at chapter 3. Men put the chapter. Men put the chapter break. This second epistle, beloved, I now write unto you to stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. This is the same subject. He's still talking. In the last days, there's going to be scoffers. Now, we've heard all about those who would despise government in the church with you, who promise liberty, freedom from the bondage taught by Herbert Armstrong. And you've got to teach he wasn't the Elijah, because if he was the Elijah, then he said he restored government. Oh, we've got to obey it. So you've got to do away with he was the Elijah. It all fits, and the devil knows it fits. That's why he knows exactly where to strike the dominoes so that all the others will eventually collapse. He knows exactly where to strike. You strike in the doctrine that's everything, and you know what you have? You have God's people scattered and lots of quote-unquote princes telling them it's what God wants. And when they're scattered, they can't do the work. They're not going to pay God's tithes. They're not going to be corrected, and all the other things. They're not going to assemble together in the right place. They're not going to be taught the full truth. The devil understands that when he knocks down, chops the government tree down at the roots, far more falls over. Is rebellion just having a few disagreements? It's much, much worse than that. Much worse than that. Now let's, after we've heard warnings about government, now let's go examine, for the balance of the sermon, the birth of the New Testament church. Let's set the scene. The church in the wilderness has come to an end. Christ is about to die, and from the New Testament forward, he's going to ready himself to marry spiritual Israel. He ultimately divorced physical Israel, so he decided to wait. That was his decision. Now, this is the same Jesus Christ who said in the Old Testament, I am the eternal, I change not. And in the New Testament, as we said earlier, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. Here he is now in the flesh, and he makes this remarkable statement in Matthew 16. Let's turn over there. He says something that is different. A prophecy from Joel is about to be fulfilled, that God would pour out his spirit on all flesh, not just Abel, Noah, Enoch, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the prophets, David, Job, and so forth. Now he's going to call many more. In the Old Testament, he went from working with one person and one person to building a whole church in the wilderness of millions. Now in the New Testament, he's going to begin to work with a group again, only this time pour his spirit into them. Now this is where everybody jumps the track. They throw everything aside and say government's all different in the New Testament. By now, I hope you understand it isn't, but let's take a look at what Christ said at this extraordinary moment. A brand new baby, if you will, is about to be born. In the Old Testament, we saw there was the birth of the church, and instantly Moses was put over it. Now, here we are. We swing to the New Testament. 1,500 years has passed, or whatever it was. Not quite 1,500 years. And we've reached Matthew 16 and verse 18. And I say also unto you, that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, whatsoever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now let's stop and examine what we just saw. Christ said, for the first time, I'm going to build my church. You've not seen that anywhere before. You've seen a message about government given to us through the Matthew 8 account with the centurion and the healing. Christ had not talked about building his church to this point. I will build my church. immediately in the exact same verse, completely misunderstood by the Catholics, of course, he names a single man. Not a verse later, or three or five verses later, immediately he names a single man. A single man. Same verse. Now the Catholics seem to see this. The splinters, by the way, have forgotten it. The Catholics, of course, as they do with every other doctrine, counterfeit it. And they say Peter was the first pope. And I could bring you a lot of quotes, perhaps next time we'll, but you can go back and maybe read them on your own from chapter 1 of the Sabbath booklet, where they say that in that authority with Peter, he could change doctrine, he could do anything he wanted. He absolutely had total authority to bind and loose, and they misunderstand. And they say he could change the Sabbath to Sunday. And all popes who carry those same keys to the kingdom can change doctrine any way they want. They're infallible because God has to bind in heaven what they bind on earth. That's where the Catholics go wrong. They think that the rock that Christ built on was Peter, the first vicar of Christ, in place of Christ, that's what vicar means, on earth. They misunderstand. They say, it was Peter. No, Peter, of course, just let me refresh briefly, Peter was a little Petros, a little pebble, a small stone, Petros. And upon this rock, I will build my church. Now, I've explained this in other literature. I don't know that Mr. Armstrong ever exactly explained this, but I chose to do it. I went to Caesarea Philippi, and I've stood in that town, and I looked up where, roughly, Christ would have said this statement. You look up at verse 13, when Jesus came unto the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he came to his disciples, who the men say that I am. Now, Christ was standing underneath a massive, massive rock. It was the El Capitan, for those who are familiar with the Yosemite, of its day. Picture him, it's right where one of the main branches, there are three branches of the Jordan River, just bursts right out of the ground. I've stood right there, it's incredible. You have an instant river like Mammoth Springs, Arkansas. It just comes right out of the ground, and instant river, and it's one-third of what becomes the Jordan. And it's at the bottom of this incredible rock cliff, right at the bottom of it. And Christ is standing, and he's saying, upon this Petra, this rock. Well, there was nobody standing there who could have possibly thought that he meant. He was talking about a little pebble. Peter was going to be a pope, that he had power to change doctrine, do anything he wanted. Could never have thought that. Impossible. They're standing under a El Capitan, as it were, which is a 3,000-foot sheer cliff. I've stood at the very base of El Capitan, and I've stood at the base of that rock in Caesarea Philippi, and except that that's a ragged surface, and Yosemite is not. They're much the same. I've stood right at the bottom of El Capitan and touched the rock, and right at the bottom of Caesarea Philippi. I know the difference between a Petra and a little pebble, a Petros. What Christ was saying is, you're a chip off the old block, if I could use the analogy. You're rock-like, Peter, but you're a little stone. He wasn't even a lithos, which is a medium-sized stone, like a water wheel or a stone in front of a tomb. He was a little tiny stone, but he was a chip off the massive rock. Who's the rock? Christ was the rock of the Old Testament, 1 Corinthians 10:4. David said, Lord, you are my rock, the rock of my salvation. No question he was talking about he built the church on himself. But a little chip off the old block was going to lead it right out of the gate. This time, Moses was named Peter. Instantly, you can't say, I'm going to build my church. He immediately knew there had to be government in that church. And right there. And he explained government. Now you've got the keys to the kingdom. We understand that's the keys of knowledge. I could take you to other verses and show that. It's knowledge. You have the truth. The truth sets you free and so forth. Now you may have to make judgments in the church. What you bind, I will bind. What you loose, I loose. Do you know what he's saying? There's authority there. The Catholics look and say, wow, there's authority there to change truth. No, there isn't. That's why I cannot ever change what's restored. I cannot do that. Or you know what I did? I just became Catholic. I have taken the government of God and misused it. The moment I come along and bring you some different instruction, Mr. Pack's ideas. Well, Mr. Armstrong forgot to restore some things. Let me tell you about them. Then we got trouble. It certainly wasn't because Peter was perfect, because verse 21, from that time forth, began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him. What a pope he was. Be it far from you, Lord. This shall not be unto you. The very first thing that Peter, who is to lead the church, does is have an attitude that is literally satanic. But he wasn't trying to be evil. He was trying to protect Christ. This is the same fellow who said, oh, if you're going to wash my feet, well, let's just do the whole thing. My head, my hands, everything. And he said, Peter, get behind me. You're an offense unto me. Called him Satan. For you savor not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Well, at the end of the book of John, an extraordinary exchange takes place. Let's turn over there. We've established the introduction of the church, a single man is named. The book of John, chapter 21, now Christ is once again talking to the disciples, verse 14. This is now the third time that Jesus showed himself to the disciples after he was crucified, after that he was risen from the dead. The New Testament church is not officially established, but Christ has been crucified and everything's in place. So when they had dined, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, love you me more than these? He said unto him, yes, Lord, you know that I like you, philia, a brotherly love for you. Said unto him, then feed my lambs. And he said to him again the second time, Simon, I didn't say it to the others. Keep that in mind. He's establishing Peter. Do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said, feed my sheep. He said unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, love you me? Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, love you me? And he said unto him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said unto him, feed my sheep. Now Christ might have had room to doubt after Peter said, I'll never deny you, and denied him three times. Christ said, you will, and even told that he would, he did it anyway. So anybody who says Peter was picked because he was perfect, just think of those two examples. And he had to have his nose rubbed by Christ. Now look, he didn't say, I want all 12 of you. I want to talk to all 12 of you. They were there. Why didn't he just talk to all 12 of them? He focused on Peter. Just turn the page. The church is now about to be born. Pentecost has come. After a 10-day wait from chapter 1, chapter 2 begins. And when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. And suddenly there came a sound from heaven, a rushing mighty wind. This prophecy of Joel is fulfilled. God's Spirit comes. Filled the house where they were sitting. They appeared unto them. This had never happened before. Didn't happen in Old Testament Israel. There was the pillar and the cloud and one man who led millions who did not have God's Spirit, who were not yet holy, just thought they were. And it sat upon each of them. They were all filled with the Holy Spirit, began to speak in tongues. They were dwelling at Jerusalem, devout men, and they heard every man. And the end of verse 6, in his own language, they're all amazed and marveled. In verse 9, there were Parthians, Medes, Elamites, Mesopotamians, Judeans, Cappadocians, Pontus, all kinds of people. Verse 11, and we do hear them speak in our languages the wonderful works of God. Verse 14, but Peter, standing up with the 11, they're right there, it's not like they're out of town, lifted up his voice and said unto them, how did Peter know to do that? How did Peter know now the church is actually being born? It's not just the promise that there would come this church and it won't die out. And Peter, you're the little rock. Now Christ is crucified. Peter's been told, feed my sheep, you know, feed my sheep three times. Yes, I will, yes, I will, yes, I will. Boom. He understood his role. The church is born. Why was it? Okay, it's just another coincidence. It's three straight coincidences. Christ has said, I'm going to build my church. Peter, you're a rock. Oh, that's a coincidence. Next time, last time he's going to see them, and he says, or next to last time, and he says, feed my sheep to Peter. And finally, here comes the sermon. Was Peter presumptuous? How did Peter know to stand up? Because he had been designated in charge in the New Testament church. Not as a pope, brethren. I think we understand that. I hope I don't have to say that. But I'll tell you, there are princes among the splinters who will tell you that that's exactly what Mr. Armstrong did when he adopted what they love to sneeringly call the Petrine doctrine. The primacy of Peter doctrine, they will call it. They spit it out like many people spit out the word the Jews. You know, they always said the Peter doctrine. We will pick up next time from this point.